big story of how I'm trying to make you love me just as I love you. At night I lie awake and try to make my heart behave, but I can't forget that since we met I've been your slave. I know a story of love undying. It is a story of my love for you.
Here's it's a story song, and you know it's a story song because very little of it actually rhymes. Yes, everything else I do rhymes, so this one doesn't really rhyme much. And it's called At the Broken Heart Shop. So, I know, yeah, it's a story, it's not really true. Alright, I'll give it a go. Good morning, I'm sorry, how can I help you? Questioned the man who stood at the counter. My woman has left me, she took little bits of my ticker. I think I need a repair. It's worse than you thought, you're missing a chamber. Here is a loaner, come back in 3 days. The customer smiled, though rather meekly, whispered a thank you and skulked out the door. At the Broken Heart Shop. At the Broken Heart Shop. Good morning, I'm sorry, how can I help you? Questioned the man who stood at the counter. The unit you loaned me suffered a rupture after a beautiful girl said hello. Your timing is perfect, the chamber you needed has been replaced, pay me $10.98. The customer exchanged the money and organs and gingerly tiptoed out the red door. At the Broken Heart Shop. At the Broken Heart Shop. Good morning, I'm sorry, how can I help you? Questioned the worker, a bit annoyed. I've been unlucky, for the third time I saw a sad movie, it split into slivers. You'll need a whole new one, I've done all I can for you. I would suggest that you never leave home. The customer whimpered, acknowledged the advice, and defeatedly walked to the street. At the Broken Heart Shop. At the Broken Heart Shop. Some folks have no luck, the customer thought. All of this love stuff could be for naught. The customer came back just 3 days later to return his one heart he had given up. But behind the counter there now stood a lady, angelic, voluptuous, available. How can I help you? Asked the new woman. I think I love you, can I share your heart? They signed an agreement and agreed to meet the next evening, shortly past closing time, at the Broken Heart Shop. At the Broken Heart Shop. The following morning, the man was awakened by a tremendously loud and sweet sound. He thought he was dreaming, but much to his horror, the happiness hydrogen bomb had been dropped. All living creatures forever and ever would now be ecstatic and filled up with love. He ran at his fastest to meet his new woman. The sign on the door said, closed for good. At the Broken Heart Shop. At the Broken Heart Shop.
Thank you.
Let's go. Okay. We're going to ask for one more favor, okay? We're going full Springsteen. Full Springsteen on you. I say 1, 2. You say 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you do that for us? Are you ready? I said 1, 2.
1, 2, 3, 4. I'm on my way to the gym. New shirt, new shorts, new shoes, new socks, new me. It's a brand new me. I say, what up to Tim? He's the guy that signed me up for a 3-year contract. I'm locked in for 3. I do my stretching routine. Got a thing with my neck and my hip and my back and my foot. Warming up is important. So now I'm ready for dumbbells, treadmills, rowing machine. Nothing is available, it's pretty crowded in here. So I do 7 push-ups and then I go to McDonald's. I get a Filet-O-Fish and a double quarter pounder with cheese, 20-piece chicken nuggies, and then I go to Wendy's. Get a spicy chicken sandy with fries and a frosty. I dip the fries in the frosty. My second day at the gym. Got a workout plan online from a Navy SEAL. It's the real fucking deal. Yesterday was a wash. Went a little overboard with the food, but that'll count as my cheat day. Even The Rock has a cheat day. So now I'm gonna eat chicken, broccoli, pinto beans, milk, eggs, pasta. No. That was a test. I passed the pasta test. Oh. Let's go, I'm at the gym. Chicka-dun-dun, chicka-dun-dun, gym. Staring at my phone, watching a show. Wheel of Fortune, I hope everyone wins. Oh, I do a bike. break. I do a 3-hole squats, then I take another break again. Only this one's longer. And then I go to a strip club. They got a sushi buffet. I think the stripper likes me. I think I'm gonna get laid. So I start drinking a lot. I call the bouncer a loser. He throws me into the street. And I get hit by a cab. And I go into a coma. I wake up. The doctor tells me been asleep for a year. I shed a single tear. I can't believe I'm alive. I won't take nothing for granted. I got the heart of a lion. I'm a miracle of science. And so I get discharged from the hospital. I say thank you, God. Now I understand. I finally know who I am. So I rob a bank. Now I'm on the run. With $23,000. Robbing a bank is a rush. I get a fraudulent passport. I change my name to Roberto. And then I move to Havana. Where I run a cockfight. I train the chickens to cheat. Someone tells the mom. They beat me to death with a bat. No one cares that I died. I should have gone to the gym. I should have gone to the gym. I should have gone to the gym.
Got a meeting with a man on the other side. And hey, this guy, he's the real thing. So if you wanna come along, you gotta promise you won't say anything. 'Cause this guy don't dance. And the word's been passed since our last chance. Gotta stay cool tonight, Eddie. 'Cause man, we got ourselves out on that line. And if we blow this one, they ain't gonna be looking for just me this time. And all we gotta do is hold up our end. You stuff this in your pocket, it'll look like you're carrying a friend. Remember, just don't smile. Change the show. It's tonight we got style. Cherry says she's gonna walk, 'cause she found I took the radio in hot day. But Eddie, man, she don't understand that 2 grand's practically sitting here in my pocket. Tonight's gonna be everything that I said. And when I walk through that door, I'm just gonna throw that money on the bed. She'll see this time I wasn't just talking. Then I'm gonna go out walking.
Mighty Caesar have returned from a quail hunting trip down in South Carolina. And on his arm is Mark Anthony, played in a picture by Mourlon Brando. And Mark Anthony speaks to the Mighty Caesar in his fluent Roman Italian voice, and he say,
"Hey, Julius." Julius say, "Huh?" He say, "Hey, Julius, like what you want around you, man?" And Julius say, "Well, let me have about me them fat, sleek-headed cats. Say that sleeps all the time and eats all the time and don't never think about nothing." He say, "At no time." He said, "Uh-huh." He say, "Julius, you a mess." He said, "Uh-huh." About that time, Mark say, "Hark." "Nay, hark," spake Mark. He said, "Durst. Oh, receive the spirit of that word, dear hearts. Durst, D-U-R-S-T. Durst thou not perceive some kind of audible vibration emanating from behind yon potted plant?" Says, "Uh-huh," said, "Indubitably I do." Say, "Well, what do it sound like to you?" Say, "Well, what it sound like to me might sound different to you." Say, "Well, what do it sound like to both of us?" Say, "You generalize it." He said, "Well, what it is?" He said, "Now we getting somewhere." He say, "It's the soothsayer and the soothsayer say." Beware the odds of March. What do he mean by that, Julius? And he say, "I doesn't know." But Julius, you just like Kennedy. You supposed to know everything. He said, "I does, but I don't know that." He said, "Julius, too much." About that time, he say, "Hey, Julius." And Julius say, "Huh?" Which is Latin for what? He say, "Julius, what you don't want around you?" And he say, "Oh, don't let me have nobody about me like yon Cassius. Cause he have that lean and hungry look. And said he do not eat, now do he sleep. And he nibbles him no dose and drinking that air wick. And he sits in that little house away from the house and he meditates. Oh, he thinks too much, he about half smart." He said, "Thou hast said." And he say, "Bye, Julius." And he say, "Adios." That's Spanish for bye. Now, straight away, Cassius is approached by Brutus, the noblest Roman of them all, played in the picture by James Rommel, the Desert Mason. He say, "Hail, Brutus." He say, "Hail, yes." He say, "Come here, Brutus." He say, "Come here." He say, "All right, what you got on? You mind?" He say, "Uh-huh." He say, "Look, I want you to do something other to Julius." And he say, "How come?" He say, "Cause I say so." He say, "Well, I'll say so." And he say, "So?" Oh, he departed there running, his blue suede tennis shod feet pounding the pavement. his sheet girded around his being. He swings upon his new swim bicycle, Mr. Seat. Pedals out through the streets of Rome, Georgia. With his sheet flowing in the breeze and his bicycle clip on his arm to keep the sheet out of the sprocket. Yes, he rides up the steps of the Senate Hall, in through the swinging doors. He stops, jumps off his bicycle. He kicks down the kick-up stand. No, he kicks up the kick-down stand. Kicks the bicycle over again, the door jam. There he seen Julius. There he seen Julius. Still sounds right. There he seen Julius in all of his radiant glory, with this chlorophyll around his head, his arm draped over the television set, eating a locust leg, watching the Helen of Troy story. He say, "Hey, Julius." Well, Julius is happy to see Brutus, beloved, because they've been down to Gaul together, and that's right behind the bladder. And he's ignorant of this premeditated conspiracy to flat get him cooked up by these senatorial cats. So he say, "Hey." "Hey, Brutus." Brutus say, "Julius, I have something other for you." And Julius say, "Do." And he said, "Uh-huh." He said, "What hast thou brung, me?" And he says, "Nay, nay, thou hast brought thyself. Grab that, friends. Weigh it." Brutus reached to the depths of the pocket of his sheet, and he withdrew briskly a long, slim, thin switchblade pocket knife. Oh, he presses a button and the blade flies out. Picks it up and sticks it back in the handle. You see, in other words, he reinserted the blade into the source from whence it emanated before he had to press the release mechanism. Ain't that weird? Try not to be obvious about it as he smit to Ethric with this here knife. The cutting edge on it was honed to such fine sharpness that when he breathed upon it, it cut the little microbes in two, and they screamed as they fell on each side. Eek, eek. He say, "Here, Julius, hold this." Cause it hurt him. The mighty Caesar mortally wounded. The ego ebbing out of his crazy little mixed up fuel pump. His massive feet tangling in Brutus's bicycle spokes. Clasping a great handful of chitterlings. He say, "Et tu, Brutus?" And he said, "No, man, I ain't at nothing."
Now the minstrels sing of an English king of many long years ago. He ruled his land with an iron hand, though his morals were weak and low. His only outer garment was a dirty yellow shirt, with which he tried to hide his hide, but he couldn't hide the dirt. He was dirty and lousy and full of fleas, but he had his women by twos and threes. God bless the bastard king of England. Now the Queen of Spain was an amorous Jane, a lascivious wench was she. She longed to play in her loving way with the king across the sea. So she sent a royal message with a royal messenger to invite the king of England down to spend the night with her. He was dirty and lousy and full of fleas, and he had his women by twos and threes. God bless the bastard king of England. Well, when Philip of France, he heard it by chance, he declared before his court, "The queen prefers my rival just because I'm somewhat short." So he sent the count of Zippity-Zap to give to the queen a dose of clap to pass it on to the bastard king of England. He was dirty and lousy and full of fleas, but he had his women by twos and threes. God bless the bastard king of England. When the king of England heard the news, he cursed the Gallic farce. He up and swore by the royal whore he'd have the Frenchman's arse. He offered half the royal purse and a piece of Queen Hortense to any British subject who'd undo the king of France. He was dirty and lousy and full of fleas, but he had his women by twos and threes. God bless the bastard king of England. So the Earl of Sussex jumped on his horse and straightway rode to France, where he made a pass and he stripped the sash from Philip's pajama pants. And in front of the throng he slipped on a thong, leaped on his horse and galloped along, dragging the Frenchman back to merry England. He was dirty and lousy and full of fleas, but he had his women by twos and threes. God bless the bastard king of England. When the king of England he saw the sight, he fell in a faint on the floor, for during the ride his rival's hide was stretched a yard or more. And all the maids of England came down to London town and shouted around the battlements, to hell with a British crown. So Philip of France usurped the throne, a scepter was the royal bone with which he'd bitch the bastard king of England. He was dirty and lousy and full of fleas, but he had his women by twos and threes. God bless the bastard king of England.
Dusk is a very different experience in the pastoral, unblemished surroundings of the mountains. I truly believe there is no such thing as dusk in the city. Think about it. After you spend a day in a society whose prevailing philosophy is, why make small problems when you can create a holocaust? Then you must navigate your way home with a society who maintains the same philosophy in their driving. Yeah. There is no such thing as dusk in the city. Well, now I sat on the porch of an old run-down cabin in a chair that squeaked just looking at it, embracing the deep, unspoiled tranquility of dusk. Every sound was as sharp as broken glass. I could even hear the steam rise from the hot cup of freshly brewed coffee I held in my sore, blistered, virgin hands. The sun was setting on tall pines that reached their heads to the deep azure sky, dusted with wisps of ash orange. I leaned up against the cabin wall and was just about ready to put the light out on the big Cuban I was chewing on. And you know, I realized the shadow working its way towards me wasn't a shadow. Now, I hadn't seen a soul in this neck of the woods all week long, although it wasn't all that uncommon to see some folk mosey by with a friendly hi, casual wave on their way to the top of the mountain. But it was quite uncommon to see a lady dressed in a long, flowing white gown. Her deep auburn hair shone bronze and gold in the setting sun. Her eyes alight like a fire staring at me from way inside her, like an animal looking out from the brush. Of course, I took this moment about as lightheartedly as a coronary, felt the deafening roar of silence inside me when she said, "Mister, you're sitting on my chair." Her sheer smoothness was alien, even intimidating. She grabbed my hand and led me inside the cabin. We walked to the large room I called the living room, and she pulled back an ancient rug to reveal a hinged door. The door led to a spiral staircase, and before I knew it, we stood at the bottom of the staircase facing a remote, majestic chap in regal-looking boots and a double-humped camel by his side. She called him Frank, the chap. We spent the better half of the next 4 days traveling sand dunes and hard winds. On two occasions, I thought I would be left behind, but Frank hefted me on the camel after cooling my parched lips with the little water that we had left. On the fourth day, we reached a long, quiet oasis, and I dived for rich, deep water, ignoring groups of two-headed lizards and other assorted creatures. Within hours, I was awakened by the lady in the long, flowing gown. Her index finger pressed to her lips, We were besieged by a band of Arab raiders. The three of us were captured trying to escape out the backside of the oasis and held prisoner for, as near as I could calculate, 8 days. I must have passed out from the lack of food because I don't recall how I got on board an old freight boat. We were headed down the thick brown waters of a wide river with thick jungle on both sides. It was just her and I again. Somehow we had escaped. Frank again, slipping me on board this stinky ship before he caught a half dozen arrows in the back. We drifted for days. Most of the time in thick fog and torrential rain. She and I talked about our pasts and our futures if we ever got out of this mess. Well, I'd lost all track of time, but one morning I woke up to the melody of birds and a streak of sunlight across the window of my room below deck. A note laid beside my head on the pillow. I stuck it in my shirt pocket and climbed the stairs, grabbed a tin cup of coffee, and sat on the bow to read the note. She was gone. Apparently, earlier in the morning, on a small fishing boat passing the other way. She simply wrote, "Unfinished business. You'll understand." Well, here I am, a few years later, a few years older. I'm romancing another beautiful dusk in the mountains on the porch of an old familiar cabin. There is no chair this time. It was replaced by a note. She simply wrote, "Love is a rare opportunity. And when that love is somehow parted, it's something deep down inside that wants just a reminder. A slice of memory. A possession. I thought you might want to know why I came for Frank's favorite chair. Now you understand. There is no such thing as dusk in the city."
I was living in Memphis, Tennessee at the time. It was about 1993, and I was playing around in the bars making my living, and I just got a record contract, which was very exciting to me, the idea that I would be able to make songs in the studio and all that. But the only hitch was that the record company, they told me they didn't want me to play any more shows in Memphis until the record came out, and that way when the record came out, we could have a big show. But I made my living playing in these bars, and I'd already blown my advance. And so I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do. So I called him up and I said, "Hey man, you know, I don't know how to keep my lights on or eat food or anything if I don't play in the bars of Memphis." And I remember it was Bob Mercer, he's still a friend of mine, he was in charge. He says, "The album's gonna change your life, son." And I said, "Yeah, but what about till then?" And he said, "Seriously, the record's gonna change your life." So I didn't bring it up again. And I went back home and I started thinking, how am I going to make a living, man? So I got this idea and I called him up and I said, "What if I join another band that I'm not the singer of? They don't say my name. That's not going to impact our show." And they said, "Okay, that's a good idea." So I got in the paper and I saw an audition for a guy to play rhythm guitar in a country band. And they needed a bass player and they needed an acoustic guitar player. So me and my friend who played bass, we went in, we auditioned, and it was a band that was going to play the current country hits of the day. And they were called KK Rider. And the singer's name was KK. And he had this kick-ass hat, and he had this white leather jacket with tassels that hung down on the side. And when he'd sing, he'd close his eyes, and he'd lean into it. And I get the gig, but I'm the rhythm guitar player, so I wouldn't be standing here. I'd be like back here and over here. That'd be my spot, say, right? So I'm standing over there in this group. And now, the story I wanted to tell you about is how I got to be the singer, which is a classic show business story about being in the right place at the right time. We were playing a pool hall in Memphis, Tennessee. And the pool hall had a gimmick where they had a rope swing that hung down from the short ceiling of the bar, red velvet rope swing. And if you lofted up gently on this swing, there was a bell attached to the ceiling and another bell behind it attached to the ceiling. And every once in a while, a cute little girl in a short skirt would come out get up on this thing, loft up gently, touch the bell, loft back gently, touch the other bell, and the crowd would go crazy because that meant drinks were half price or there was some sort of special going on until this happened again. And I'd be standing over here, you know. And the swing went back and towards us, you know. So it'd be this girl coming towards us and then back away from us. And I remember on this particular occasion, the band we were playing, that Jerry Jeff, I mentioned him earlier, we were playing, actually Rusty Weir, God rest his soul, wrote this. We were playing, "Don't it make you want to dance? Don't it make you want to smile?" And you all know that one. "When you're down, down, down in the country picking sing." So K.K. Ryder got his eyes closed. He's leaning into it. His tassels are flaring in the wind. I'm standing over here holding down the rhythm. He's singing his song. This cute little girl gets up, lofts gently, touches the bell, lofts back, touches the other bell. Crowd goes great. Half price drinks. We're all having a good time. I'm standing over there playing rhythm. K.K.'s got his tassels swinging. He's singing the Rusty Weir song. Now, here's the funny part. After the girl gets down, a whole other girl, real skinny looking little southern girl in a 38 special t-shirt, she gets up on the swing and she starts swinging back and forth, and I can tell right away by her age and by what she has on that she doesn't impact the drink specials at all. She's just doing this, and KK Ryder's got his eyes closed and he's singing. I'm over here, I'm watching this girl. And she's swinging back and forth, and I'm wondering if she's supposed to be doing it, but just as I wonder, I can tell that she's not, because the owner of the bar comes flying out behind, from behind the bar for what I'm imagining are insurance reasons, and he's like, "She can't do that." Now, just as he says that she can't do this, her old man stands up, and he's pissed, and he's got a 38 special t-shirt on, too. Different tour, same band. He stands up. And he gets in front of the owner of the bar as the bar owner's trying to tell her that she can't be on this swing. And he's probably thinking, "I paid a cover. I'll swing on any goddamn thing I want to in here." He stands up and he sticks his chest out. The owner, you know how guys, the girls don't do this, but guys stick their chests out. You know how they bounce their chests off each other? That means they're upset, I guess. I'm not sure. I don't understand it. But that's where it's at. They're pressing their chests against each other. And they're yelling at each other, and they're not paying attention to her. And she has already lofted up gently and hit one bell and lofted up gently. She's beyond the lofting and the gently. She's still kicking her legs back and forth like she's on a swing in the park. And she's picking up fucking speed. And they're arguing about whether or not she should be up there. And I'm standing over here like... K.K. Ryder's got his tassels in the wind. He's got his eyes closed. He's singing that Rusty Weir song with all that he has inside of himself. And this girl is picking up speed. And these two guys are arguing. And I swear to God, at some point, it's just going bing, 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 bing. And she's clearly injuring herself. Everybody paying attention knows this at this point, except for these two guys. And then the boyfriend turns around and he looks up and he sees... my girlfriend's clearly hurting herself. He does the dumbest fucking thing he does the whole night. Well, wait a minute. I don't know where they went afterwards. So he did the dumbest thing that I saw him do the whole night. He turns around and, as God is my witness, he grabs this rope to stop his girlfriend. Abruptly grabs it. She comes flying out of it like a catapult towards us. K.K. Ryder's got his tassel swinging, his eyes closed, his hat on, he's singing with all his heart. I'm standing over here playing rhythm guitar. Here she comes right at us, man. And I wouldn't make this up, and who would? She lands right in front of these monitors, right between the monitors and the microphone stand. The microphone stand goes this way, back that way, like James Brown trick, and then hits K.K. Ryder right in the chips. Boom! Hits him right in the mouth, and he's out like a light. And he goes down this way, and he's laying this way. I'm pretty sure this chick was unconscious as she was coming towards us, but she's as unconscious as well, and she's laying this way. So they're forming a T. The microphone has corrected itself, and it's still standing there. She's unconscious this way. He's unconscious this way. I'm standing over here. And I'm thinking to myself, I know the words to this one. One of them classic show business success stories about being in the right place at the right time. Don't make you want
that. All right, so what happened after that? I mean, did they get their teeth back? I mean, did I don't know. Anyway, it's not important because stories exist in kind of a two-dimensional land of their own, and outside of that, they don't exist. So there you go. But tonight we bring you more of them because this is what we do around here. We tell stories written by people who know how to tell stories. That's how I put it. Anyway, we started out with Spike Jones and the City Slickers in the declining years, I guess. And that was called I Know a Story. I think it might have been Carl Grayson on vocals, but I'm not sure. Let's see. Mitch Friedman, New York City boy. Took songwriting classes with Ray Davies, and that was at the Broken Heart Shop, and I liked that a lot. Following that, we went with the Wolves of Glendale to the gym, and that did not work out so well. We should have gone back. Let's see, Meeting Across the River was Bruce Springsteen. Remember him? Yeah, this is always one of my favorites of his. And this one, just because you know these guys screwed up and... Tonight is our last ride. Okay, Brother Dave Gardner, Southern comedian. That was his take on Julius Caesar. Oscar Brand, Bastard King of England, the Bastard King of England from one of his bawdy folk song collections. Let's see, Frank's Chair was Too New, two guys, with band, I guess, and that was Frank's Chair. Enough said. Todd Snyder, one of the master storytellers out there today, and that was the KK Writer story, and I loved that. I really did, and I really wonder what happened to all the teeth. But anyway, we're just rolling along telling stories tonight, because this is how we're going to be transmitting our history in the near future, because we won't have electronics anymore. You want to argue with me? Fine, go ahead. But anyway, right now, because I'm in control of everything, a commercial.
Tony?
Yes, Ned?
Remember when you had to bring smelly old Irish priests into your house to rid loved ones of hideous demons like Beelzebub, Katzenberg, Obits, and Cher?
I sure do.
Tony, are you tired of pea stains on your Persians and pea soup flashed all over your ice-cold bedroom floor?
I sure am.
Well, your prayers have been answered.
No!
Here's the man with the machine that's turning heads all over Christendom.
Thank you, Ned, and hello, folks. Are you excited?
Yes.
I'm excited. Let's not wait a second. Let me bring in our world-class discoverer and valedictorian of the Guadalajara Overnight School of Medicine, the inventor of the Devil Master, Dr. Bill Infirmo.
Thank you.
Bill, what yes. In the name of all that's holy possessed you to invent this infernal machine?
Well, as you know, Tony, everybody has one or two great thoughts, and mine was simple. We're all doomed.
Okay, bad dinker.
A good starting point. I think we can agree with that.
So, where do we go from here?
Well, then I had a second thought. I thought to myself that just because you're surrounded by evil doesn't mean you can't make some money from it.
Oh, I know. We can all agree with that, can't we?
So, how does it work, Bill?
Well, Ned... Unlike most demon expulsion machines, the Devil Master by Infirm Co. totally rotates the entire upper body while the head remains stationary.
Uh-huh.
Its eyes fixed on the money it's going to make. No, on the money you're going to make.
Wait a minute. Are you saying out demons out and in profits in?
Yes. I am.
That's wonderful!
I think so, too. Now, boys, here's the best part. We have a young star here from, remember, Corn Cousins?
Here she
is, teenage vixen Esther Woodrosen.
Oh.
And she's working out on my Devil Master.
Look at that body!
What's that smell?
Makes your head spin!
I think that's Asphodel coming out of her orifice. Stand back, boys. Roll up your pants.
Wait a minute. What's that?
What is that?
We're doomed.
That's the Devil Master Exerciser GT. Send your credit card now to What Would Satan Say, WrestleMania, Minnesota.
One time, a long time ago, over in the old country, they lived this king, and he was a pretty good old king, real well-to-do. He had three or four closets full of silk robes that he wore, velvet knee breeches, buckles on his shoes, had rings for every finger, two crowns, one for every day and one for Sunday, and he lived in a big, fine castle, two floors with a moat, in the suburbs of London, over there in England. And he had all kinds of counselors and wizards and advisors and handmaidens and butlers. And one fella didn't do nothing but take care of the moat. And he had the prettiest daughter you ever laid your eyes on. She had this real clear skin, and he was happy. There was one bad thing about living where he did, though. There was this great big giant that lived in the woods near there, and he had this 60-foot dragon for a pet. Dragon breathed fire out of his mouth and smoke out of his nose, and they was both big and mean and ugly. Caused untold damage and destruction all over the countryside. And the king kept sending soldiers in there to kill that giant and dragon, and the giant and dragon kept killing the soldiers. And the king's army was getting smaller and smaller. And the king got worried about that thing, you know, in case there was to come along a war. And none of his advisors, nor counselors, nor wizards could tell him what to do. They was stumped. They used to say that a whole lot. They'd say, "King, we are stumped." Even the head wizard couldn't do nothing. He'd say, "King, I'm sorry as I can be. You got some warts you want me to take off? I can take off your warts. But I can't do nothing about that giant and that dragon. I'm stumped." And so the king got on his royal golden carriage and went uptown, took his beautiful daughter with him, and he gathered all the people together there in the square, and he got up and he says, "Hark. Says, hark, behold, hear ye. Says, anybody that'll go in them woods and kill that giant and that dragon, I'll give them half of my cattle and half of my kingdom, and they can marry my beautiful daughter, the one with the clear skin." And there was a voice from the back that says, "Now you said something, King." And everybody turned around and saw the one that volunteered was a boy named Jack. See, he always had been stuck on that princess. He used to be in her class at Sunday school. And he walked right over and got right up in the carriage, sat right down by the princess, took a hold of her hand, looked her right in the eye, and says, "Hey, honey," says, "I'm gonna kiss you right on the mouth." And the king says, "Whoa," says, "Hold on," says, "Turn loose of that girl, take your hand off of her." Says, "We made a bargain about you killing that giant and that dragon and then courting my daughter. I didn't say nothing to you about courting her first." And Jack says, "Excuse me, she got tummy." Next morning, Jack was sitting around on the front porch of the castle, fixing to go in the woods and fight that giant and that dragon. And he looked over there on the porch swing, and there sat the princess, with her veil pulled down, grinning at him. And he knowed he'd have to go through with it. He went way deep in the woods there, scared to death all the time. And he heard the awfulest racket you ever heard coming up the mountain. Stomping and a hollering, and the trees were shaking like a big wind was blowing them. And boulders falling off the mountains. And here come that great big giant. And Jack thought, "Mercy, I can't stand this, let me hide." And he saw this big, tall simmon tree, and he clumb up it, figuring he'd get up higher in the giant's head and the giant wouldn't see him. Don't you know that giant was coming up there to pick simmons? And the giant saw Jack,
And he says, what are you doing in my cemetery? Says, I believe I'll kill you right now.
And Jack says, whoa. Says, hold on there, High Pockets. Says, I was just up here eating some simmons. I didn't know it was your simmon tree. Before you come over here talking about killing me, I feel I ought to tell you that I'm a elf. And the giant says, you a what? And Jack says, what's the matter with you? Ain't you got no smart? I says, I'm a elf. The elf is a being that is indestructible. And the giant says, prove it. Says, do something indestructible to yourself. And Jack says, all right, I'll cut myself open and sew myself back up and go on like nothing happened. And the giant says, I don't believe it. Says, you're some kind of a nut. And Jack was wearing this little leather apron, flesh-colored, and he cut it right across his middle like he was cutting himself and sewed it back up and was laughing and singing all the time. And he says to the giant, can you do that? And the giant says, I ain't never tried. And as it happened, that was the last thing the giant ever said. Because when he cut himself open in the middle that way, why, naturally, he died. And Jack was feeling pretty good about getting that giant killed off. And he come down out of the tree, and he was fixing going back up to the castle and tell the king about it. And he was walking along, whistling. When he did hear the awfulest racket you ever heard, and the earth was a-trembling, and trees was a-shaking, and rocks was a-falling off the mountains, and the air was hot and filled with smoke, and Jack says, law, I forgot about the dragon. Says, let me run before I get scalded. And he commenced to run. But the dragon seen him and commenced to running after him. And Jack was a-running faster and faster and faster. Run up one mountain and down another. Across meadows and through valleys. And the dragon was a-gaining on him all the time. And finally Jack come to a great big creek. And it was too wide to jump and too deep to wade. And he jumped in and commenced to swimming. And the dragon jumped in and was a-swimming after him and still a-gaining on him. And Jack could feel his hot breath on the back of his neck. And he says, I'm done for. But when the dragon got in over his head, the water put his fire out, and he drowned it. And Jack went on back up to the king's castle and courted the king's daughter pretty good. Took her uptown, everywhere, to preaching. Finally married her, and they had a good, long, happy life together, laughing and giggling to the end of their days. And they tell me that you can go in them woods over there in England right today and hardly ever see a giant or a dragon.
Twas Brillig and the Slivy Toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves and the mome raths outgrabe.
Back. and past our slain the Jabberwock. Come to my arms, my beamish boy. Oh, Frappers Day.
Kaloo! Kalay!
Chortle is yours.
Slivy Toves did gyre and gimble in the wave, all mimsy were the bottle goes in the home rats.
The Queen Bee from Grimm's Fairy Tales by Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm. Two kings' sons, once upon a time, went into the world to seek their fortunes, but they soon fell into a wasteful, foolish way of living, so that they could not return home again. Then their brother, who was a little insignificant dwarf, went out to seek for his brothers. But when he found them, they only laughed at him, to think that he, who was so young and simple, should try to travel through the world, when they, who were so much wiser, had been unable to get on. However, they all set out on their journey together, and came at last to an anthill. The two elder brothers would have pulled it down, in order to see how the poor ants in their fright would run about and carry off their eggs. But the little dwarf said, "Let the poor things enjoy themselves. I will not suffer you to trouble them." So on they went, and came to a lake where many, many ducks were swimming about. The two brothers wanted to catch two and roast them. But the dwarf said, "Let the poor things enjoy themselves. You shall not kill them." Next they came to a bee's nest in a hollow tree, and there was so much honey that it ran down the trunk, and the two brothers wanted to light a fire under the tree and kill the bees, so as to get their honey. But the dwarf held them back and said, "Let the pretty insects enjoy themselves. I cannot let you burn them." At length the three brothers came to a castle. As they passed by the stables, they saw fine horses standing there, but all were of marble, and no man was to be seen. Then they went through the rooms till they came to a door on which were three locks, but in the middle of the door was a wicket, so that they could look into the next room. There they saw a little gray old man sitting at a table, and they called to him once or twice, but he did not hear. However, they called a third time, and then he rose and came out to them. He said nothing, but took hold of them, and led them to a beautiful table covered with all sorts of good things. And when they had eaten and drunk, he showed each of them to a bedchamber. The next morning he came to the eldest and took him to a marble table, where there were three tablets containing an account of the means by which the castle might be disenchanted. The first tablet said, "In the wood under the moss lie the 1,000 pearls belonging to the king's daughter. They must all be found, and if one be missing by set of sun, he who seeks them will be turned into marble." The eldest brother set out and sought for the pearls the whole day, but the evening came, and he had not found the 100, so he was turned into stone, as the tablet had foretold. The next day the second brother undertook the task, but he succeeded no better than the first, for he could only find the 200 of the pearls, and therefore he too was turned into stone. At last came the little dwarf's turn, and he looked in the moss. But it was so hard to find the pearls, and the job was so tiresome, so he sat down upon a stone and cried. And as he sat there, the king of the ants, whose life he had saved, came to help him, with 5,000 ants, and it was not long before they had found all the pearls and laid them in a heap. The second tablet said, "The key of the princess's bedchamber must be fished up out of the lake." And as the dwarf came to the brink of it, he saw the two ducks whose lives he had saved swimming about, and they dived down and soon brought in the key from the bottom. The third task was the hardest. It was to choose out the youngest and the best of the king's three daughters. Now they were all beautiful, and all exactly alike. But he was told that the eldest had eaten a piece of sugar, the next some sweet syrup, and the youngest a spoonful of honey. So he was to guess which it was that had eaten the honey. Then came the queen of the bees, who had been saved by the little dwarf from the fire, and she tried the lips of all three. But at last she sat upon the lips of the one that had eaten the honey, and so the dwarf knew which was the youngest. Thus the spell was broken, and all who had been turned into stones awoke, and took their proper forms. And the dwarf married the youngest and best of the princesses, and was king after her father's death. But his brothers married the other two sisters. End of The Queen Bee.
Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud were friends in every way. Together they fished and they hunted through the sunny summer day. Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud could never be apart. Side by side, they walked so proud, Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud. Little Willie White Cloud was a brave Indian lad who wandered far from home one day into the mountain high. Lost and hungry, nowhere to go, but Bigfoot heard him cry. Picked him up and held him close, he couldn't let him die. Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud were friends in every way. Together they fished and they hunted through the sunny summer day. Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud could never be apart. Side by side, they walked so proud, Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud. Time had passed, rushed away. Now Willie is a man. He longed for his people in the valley below. He asked Bigfoot one day to understand, and with broken heart, Bigfoot, tears in his eyes, showed him the path to go. Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud were friends in every way. Together they fished and they hunted through the sunny summer day. Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud could never be apart. Side by side, they walk so proud, Bigfoot and Little Willie White Cloud. Shot the penicillin.
shadows carry an ounce of hash, held up the drugstore in Illinois, just a little bit short of the ready cash, jumped out the window in the noon in Alabama. I was streaking a huge guy came in.
An army buddy of mine, we're doing 3 years in Germany at the time. We came up on these Fräuleins in a bar. Yates said, "Darf ich Sie begleiten?" They said, "Ja." And "Darf ich Sie begleiten" means, "Can we sit with you all?" We must have drunk 10 quarts of German beer. My conscience and my sinuses were clear. I asked that Fräulein if she was a spy. She said, "Nein, but du bist ein bisschen high." A condition not uncommon to the American soldier. Well, later on I went to be excused. When I returned I was a bit confused. Yates and his Fräulein had hit the air. Another guy was sitting in my chair. A young soldier whom we shall get to know better. I said, "Excuse me, mister, that's my seat. I'd like to have it back, sir, if you please. That girl's a nurse and I've been awful sick." The man looked up at me and said, "Mox nix." Which means that he was not overly concerned with my health. Next thing I knew, he had a switchblade knife. Thought I didn't know that Fräulein was his wife. I took off through that guest house like a fool. Behind me, I heard the crashing stool. As the police would say, he was in hot pursuit. Well, the waitress yelled, "There's MPs on the way. That's one more reason I didn't want to stay." As I went out the window, something went swish, and I giggled all the way home, knowing he'd missed. At the time, it seemed like a laughing matter. But next morning, my coat was lying there on the bunk, and when I saw that coat, it made me jump. That man had cut my coat right down the back, a little bit more than they'd been playing me taps. And knowing the sad nature of that song, I would decline it. Well, later on I heard that guy got stabbed. They sent him home, and didn't that make me glad? On love and marriage, I want to say one thing. Oh, lady, if you're married, wear that ring. And the Army has a new policy. If you can't move it, paint it. If it has a switchblade knife, salute it. Not necessarily an incident one would want to write mother about. Germany being full of good soldiers. I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. They said for the last 2 weeks that he suffered and cried. It made a big impression on me, although I was a barefoot kid. They said he got religion at the end, and I'm glad that he did. Clayton was the best guitar picker in our town. I thought he was a hero, and I used to follow Clayton around. I often wondered why Clayton, who seemed so good to me, never took his guitar and made it down in Tennessee. Well, Daddy said he drank a lot, but I could never understand. I knew he used to pick up in Ohio with a five-piece band. Clayton used to tell me, "Son, you better put that old guitar away. Ain't no money in it, it'll lead you to an early grave." I guess if I'd admit it, Clayton taught me how to drink booze. I can see him half stoned, picking out the lovesick blues. When Clayton died, I made him a promise I was gonna carry on somehow. I'd give $100 if he could only see me now. I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. Nobody ever knew it, but I went out in the woods and I cried. While I know there's a lot of big preachers that know a lot more than I do, but it could be that the good Lord likes a little picking too. Yeah, I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died.
I took a walk.
He was walking up and down Broadway.
I was looking.
Had an eye out for a swell cafe.
I was hungry.
He was sounding for a bite to munch.
I found a spot.
He took a table at the merchant's lunch.
Oh, the merchant's lunch. It was an ocean of gloom.
It looked like half past midnight in the afternoon. Down by the bar,
a rat-faced manager was pouring suds
for the boys.
Railways, cowboys in their goodwill duds.
And the girls,
a fried-up pedal pushing pinball. All queens
chewing gum
and sweaty combat at the wizard machine.
But the queen of them all, looking big as a fort,
was Broadway Brenda and her derelict court. I owe
ordered a blue plate special and peered out through the room just to see what class of citizens inhabited this gloom. And the hapless visages I saw were in a scent of cheer, though mirthless laughter filled the air, inspired by wine and beer. Broadway Brenda rolls upon her queen-size six-foot frame. I turned away to shun her eyes, but I knew it was too late. A hand fell on my shoulder as my gaze fell on my plate. I looked her up and over,
and she did the same to me.
Her teeth were
green as garden peas.
She shaved her hair
with dishpan fingertips.
An earthquake of excitement
shook her Krakatoan hips.
Her hands went to her bosom, a hush fell on the crew.
An
acre of Brenda lay exposed to view.
These fevered words she whispered
as he gazed upon the scene.
It's a custom here at Merchant's Lunch
to entertain the queen.
I grabbed my hat,
and in an instant he was on his feet.
I was sober as a judge
down at the county seat.
He kept his diesel up to 80, way past Baton Rouge.
Made it back to Beaumont for the evening news. He owns a wide load rig.
I pay thousands in tax.
He's gonna keep it in Texas.
I ain't leaving for snacks.
He's a driving fool.
The interstate belongs to me, but I'm never going back
into the state of Tennessee.
Oh, the Merchant's Lunch, it was an ocean of gloom.
It looked like
half past midnight in the afternoon.
Was lying in his bun, just waiting for a friend to come along. Little Billy bought him from a vendor in the street, and now our epic story has begun.
I knew I didn't know where I was at.
that. I tried to find the way out, but it seemed to be in vain. The more I tried, the more confused and frightened I became. At last, in sheer exhaustion, I collapsed and fell asleep, until the distant roaring sound of thunder wakened me. The thunder boomed, the earth had shook, I trembled in my fear. Surely this must be the worst storm in a thousand years. And all the time, the fury of the storm just seemed to grow, until suddenly it ended with a great earthquaking blow. I then began to crawl around, and what a stroke of luck. I saw above a tiny light, and so I followed up. And soon I crawled from out of what I thought would be my grave. And what I saw, it made me wish I was back down in the cave. For there was not a blade of grass, a tree, or bush around. Not even one small bug crawling on the parched burnt ground. And looking down the hill, I saw the shambles of a town where people used to live before the bomb came down.
That did not work out well at all, did it? I was expecting different. Well, it's the end of that story. Coming up, the epilogue. All right. So let's see. Let me find out where we are here. Okay, we started up top with Andy Griffith. He's the master storyteller in his own. That was Jack the Giant Killer. From one of many albums from Andy, telling all kinds of stories. Jabberwocky was Roger Miller, the other Roger Miller, the one from Mission of Burma. We heard from a guy named Bob Newfield reading the Grimm Brothers' Queen Bee story. Those Grimm Brothers were like, hardcore stuff. We heard Bigfoot and Little Willie Whitefoot from Don Jones. Who's Don Jones? I don't know. Who's Bigfoot? Who's Little Willie Whitefoot? Come on, stop this. Curtis Knight, after that, Confession. Curtis Knight was this is the Zeus Curtis Knight. This is not the guy who broke Jimi Hendrix, all right? This is from 1974. We heard a pair from Tom T. Hall, Salute to a Switchblade, and The Year That Clayton Delaney Died. Man had a way of putting songs to stories to song, vice versa, back and forth, all right? Let's see, we heard the Red Clay Ramblers. That was Merchant's Lunch. And let's try this again. All right. Parry Grip after that. The Ballad of Melvin, the Magic Hot Dog. Okay. And then The Cave from Johnny Paycheck. Okay. So I'm going to leave it there for you. I got a couple more for you, but I'm going to tell you this. I will be back next week. All right. You can't get rid of me. You can't get rid of me. All right. Don't even try. I'm like a tick. Okay. Yeah. And I will see you next week. Got it? Good.
I rolled a Jimmy Diesel down from the high beam up to the Sam's Club home. I'm headed down the hills of San Bernardino, loosing 20 tons of filth and stone. That morning buzzer sounded. No pressure there. I looked at the deep and rocky canyons down below. I said, my soggy mirror. I knew there was a highwayman behind. I tried to shift her down one, but I missed it. Then she really started to unwind. Down the hill, that patrolman had a notion I could see. His boat had tried to clear the road for me. I saw a sign from 30 miles per hour. I watched a hand go round and hit the pay. That patrol car was a burning up the highway. Once the ditch, and then I lost my nerve. I sideswiped the bobcat and straightened out the curve. I opened up my eyes and I was back on level ground, and it took me 5 more miles to shut her down. That highwayman walked up and put his hand down. I reached out and shook it like a man. He shook me loose and now see your license. Don't get wise with me, I'll run you in. Now where's your restoration? Who owns this machine? He wrote me how to kick it longer than a witch's dream. There's lots of things in this world I don't understand. One of them is a doggone highwayman. One of them is a doggone highwayman.
My name is Joe Roberts. I work for the state. I'm a sergeant out in Perrinville, barracks number 8. I've always done an honest job, honest as I could. Got a brother named Frankie. Frankie ain't no good. Ever since we were young kids, it's been the same come down. I'd get a call on the short way, Frankie's in trouble downtown. Well, if it was any other man, I'd put him straight away. But sometimes when it's your brother, you look the other way. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. I catch him when he's straying, like any brother should. Man turns his back on his family. He ain't no good. Well, Frankie went into the army back in 1965. I got a farm deferment, settled down, took Maria for my wife. But them wheat prices kept on dropping till it was like we're getting robbed. Frankie came home in 68. Me, I took this job. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. I catch him when he's straying, teach him how to walk that line. Man turns his back on his family, ain't no friend of mine. night was like any other. I got a call about a quarter to nine. There was trouble at a roadhouse out on the Michigan line. There was a kid on the floor looking bad, bleeding hard from his head. There was a girl crying at a table. It was Frankie, she said. I ran out and I jumped in my car. Then I hit the lights. I must have done about 110 through Michigan County that night. It was down by the crossroads, out by Willow Bank. Seen a Buick with Ohio plates behind the wheel with Frank. Well, I chased him through them county roads till a sign said Canadian border 5 miles from here. Pulled over to the side of the highway, watched the taillights disappear. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. I catch him when he's straying, like any brother should. Man turns his back on his family. He ain't.
Their parents would never let them marry, 'cause she came from the wrong side of town. In a final embrace, you could see them standing there on the ledge, looking down. They vowed they would always be together, and that neither would ever love again. So holding each other so tightly, they kissed, and then...
And the telephone rang. I broke a guitar string, and a friend with a bottle came along. We both got a little high, started telling lies. I never did finish that song. Really, never did finish that song.
Johnny was the pride of the beach. All the surfer girls knew him on sight. It seemed like everything was going his way till that dark and fateful night. He swam out to where the big breakers were and started to ride the waves in. For the first time, he noticed the ship in his path. He waved to the crowd, and then...
And the stove
blew up. This big, huge Mack truck came crashing right through my chartreuse wall. Blocks dropped in, the whole roof caved in. I never did finish that song. Really, never did finish that song.
Old Jed was a faithful, hard man. For years he plowed the old farm, with the wrinkles of time etched in his face and a hula girl etched on his arm. But old age made Jed careless, and his years finally came to an end. He walked behind a mule that he thought was tame. The mule took aim, and then...
And then the sky got black,
the windows cracked, and a big tornado come along. Boy, the whole house rocked, the landlord knocked. I never did finish that song. I never did finish that song. I promised myself when I started this song that I'd write it all the way to the end. But I never did.